I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. It's anybody's guess as to whether or not Judge Brett Kavanaugh will replace Justice Anthony Kennedy on the Supreme Court. The FBI is said to be finishing up its supplemental background check on Mr. Kavanaugh. Former college classmates and current friends of the judge have weighed in on his fitness for the Supreme Court, and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has promised a vote this week. Today on Midday, perspectives on the Kavanaugh nomination from Cleta Mitchell, a former counsel to the National Republican Senatorial and Congressional Committees, Ian Samuel, a professor of law at Indiana University, and Thiru Vignaraja, a former federal prosecutor and the former Deputy Attorney General of Maryland. The future of the Supreme Court, when Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. On Monday, the Supreme Court met for the first time this term. Questions about Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh continue to swirl through the Washington ecosystem. Today, we're going to have a conversation about the extraordinary events at the Senate Judiciary Committee last week and what the Kavanaugh nomination, whether or not he is confirmed, means for the court moving forward. Joining me today, Thiru Vignaraja. He's a former prosecutor who was a law clerk for Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. Earlier this year, he ran in the primary for Baltimore State's attorney. He's currently a partner at the law firm DLA Piper in Baltimore. Mr. Vignaraja, good to see you, sir.
Good to see you, Tom.
And Cleta Mitchell joins us on the phone. She's a partner and political law attorney in the Washington, D.C. office of Foley and Lardner, LLP. She has served as legal counsel to the National Republican Senatorial Committee and the National Republican Congressional Committee. She's an expert in campaign finance law, election law, and ethics as it relates to lobbying. She joins us on the line from Pinehurst, North Carolina. Ms. Mitchell, welcome and thank you.
Thank you.
And a little bit later, we hope to hear from Ian Samuel. He's an associate professor of law at Indiana University, and he hosts a blog, or a podcast, rather, about the Supreme Court called First Mondays. He's been teaching a class, and he is on the way. If you would like to join our conversation, we're at 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @midday_WYPR. So, Ms. Mitchell, let me start with you. Do you know Mr. Kavanaugh? Have you ever argued a case in front of him, or do you know each other socially? Do you have any relationship with him?
I knew his wife before she and he were married, but I don't know him personally.
What was your reaction to the testimony from Judge Kavanaugh last week, as well as the testimony of Dr. Blasey Ford?
I believe him. I think that he's telling the truth. And I don't believe that he is guilty of these things of which he's been accused. I think this is part of an unfortunate plan by the Democrats and their left-wing allies to try to stop the president from being able to put on the court anyone from the list of candidates that he said he would use that list and draw from that list for purposes of selecting Supreme Court nominees. He said that in May of 2016. Judge Kavanaugh is a member, a person on that list, as was Justice Gorsuch. And I think that what is happening here is that the left and the Democrats have decided that they're going to do everything in their power to keep that from happening. I think that's what this all is. And I think I'm with Lindsey Graham. I think this is a national disgrace. I agree with Judge Kavanaugh, what he said about the process, and I think it's an unfortunate state of affairs.
I think there's a lot of folks who would agree with you about the process, but in terms of the testimony itself, when you say you believe Judge Kavanaugh, does that mean you disbelieve Ms. Ford? Would she have any reason in your mind for coming forward and saying things that are not true?
I think that she may well have. I think that the problem here is the way that this came about is not exactly the way in which something would happen if there are no holes to be poked in the in her coming forward. The fact that she gave this to a political person, the fact that she apparently didn't, you know, she told the committee that she needed to have the hearing delayed because she was afraid to fly, and it turns out, well, she flies on quite long flights and had flown to the East Coast in early August, was here for her to do a polygraph, but then said she needed to drive across country for the hearing. I mean, the way Senator Feinstein handled it, the way the Democrats handled it, the fact that Senator Feinstein had this information, she had this letter prior to the time when 64 of her colleagues met privately with Judge Kavanaugh. She didn't disclose any of this until after. She didn't disclose it in her meeting. She didn't ask him about it in her private meeting. She didn't bring it up during his public testimony. She didn't bring it up in that there's a session following the public testimony when all the senators on the Judiciary Committee can meet with a candidate, a nominee, and ask about things that maybe they didn't feel comfortable asking about publicly. She didn't even attend that session when Judge Kavanaugh came. When this letter was leaked, remember, that's how this became public. That's how it became known. It was leaked. It was leaked from someone in Senator Feinstein's office. Now, she says maybe it was a friend or a husband. Who knows? But the fact of the matter is they've completely disregarded the rule of law and the process by which these things are supposed to be handled and have turned it into a spectacle. And the kinds of behavior, let us not forget the behavior of the organized left and the fact that they were paying protesters during the first round of his hearings. It's hard for me to believe that this is not all part of a plan out. People can say something happened to her and I believe her. I'm just not going to go there. I'm just going to say she's part of an orchestrated smear campaign against someone who in his entire adult life has never demonstrated a single untoward act toward any female. And we have that attested to by many, many dozens of women.
Mm-hmm. And so, through Vigna Raja, Christine Blasey Ford did write a letter to her congressional representative before Mr. Kavanaugh was even nominated. But your reaction to the hearing and to what's transpired since?
You know, the only thing I agree with about what's been said so far is that it is a really unfortunate spectacle. What was supposed to be the advice and consent function of the Senate has become a partisan circus. And I think that is really disappointing for everyone. But be clear, I think that Professor Ford's experience coming forward at a time, significantly later than when the trauma and the attack happened is not uncommon at all. As a prosecutor, we routinely see people that are survivors of these crimes come forward for complicated reasons, but often not around the time of the assault. And Professor Ford, I think, really persuasively explained what led her to ultimately come forward. I think most folks, everybody from President Trump to Fox News, watched that and reacted the same way, which is that she was incredibly compelling and incredibly credible. She gave an explanation for why she came forward, when she came forward, what she remembers, why she remembers those details, why she doesn't remember other details. And I think most folks who would watch that in a nonpartisan would say, listen, this is not the product of fiction. It is not the product of some, orchestrated smear campaign. It is the product of a woman who survived a trauma and an attack a long time ago and is doing her best to do what she believes is her civic duty.
Let's listen to a little bit of Judge Kavanaugh in his opening statement last Thursday before the Senate Judiciary Committee.
This whole two-week effort has been a calculated and orchestrated political hit, fueled with apparent pent-up anger about President Trump and the 2016 election, fear that has been unfairly stoked about my judicial record, revenge on behalf of the Clintons, and millions of dollars in money from outside left-wing opposition groups. This is a circus.
Let me invite Ian Samuel to join our conversation. He's an associate professor of law at Indiana University, and he co-hosts a weekly podcast about the court called First Monday. He joins us from the studios of WFIU at IU in Bloomington. Mr. Samuel, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
So Judge Kavanaugh's remarks, I mean, when you look at a guy like Michael Avenatti, who's representing a woman who's also making allegations against Judge Kavanaugh, and his very reality TV show circus-like reveal of who his client was and when she was going to talk, et cetera, there have been a lot of money spent on both sides of this argument, on television advertising. Ms. Mitchell mentions the possibility of paying some protesters. That's not been completely vetted by the press, as far as I know. But your reaction to Mr. Kavanaugh's contention that this is an orchestrated and coordinated hit job, and is there any evidence, as far as you can see, that Dr. Blasey Ford herself was part of this calculated effort?
Well, I think it was Will Rogers who once remarked, "I'm not a member of any organized political party. I'm a Democrat." And it is extremely hard for me to believe, as the first speaker suggested, that this conspiracy to falsify this information exists. First of all, this conspiracy would have to have existed since at least 2012, which is when she first described this attack to her doctor in the context of couples therapy, and described Judge Kavanaugh and what she said had happened to her when she was 15. So the conspiracy would have had to start all the way back in 2012. And if you believe, as Judge Kavanaugh does, apparently, that this is some sort of orchestrated plan by the Clintons, then they would have to be thinking very far ahead indeed, and that's never a characteristic that I had really associated with them. So as far as I can tell, this is the most scurrilous kind of accusation against a person who says that she is a survivor of a very serious attack. And to say that she is part of an organized conspiracy on behalf of the left, you know, I really would have thought that people had a little more shame than to suggest something like that, but apparently they don't. There is not one iota of evidence that that is true, and it really ought, I mean, ought to, people who are saying that, they really ought to be liable for, you know, slander to Dr. Blasey Ford, in my view.
But Mr. Samuel...
Really? Well, wait. Since I'm the one that said that, and you're saying that I should be sued for libel, let me just point out something.
Not just sued, but also actually pay the judgment.
Well, she did not, even by her own testimony, she did not identify Brett Kavanaugh by name in her therapist session in 2012.
She said it was a federal judge. Who do you think she was talking about? Who do you think she was talking about?
Number two.
Who do you think she was talking about?
The therapist notes. She has refused to provide those. So we don't know. We have no idea what she actually said. We know that there were some inconsistencies, but those are because she has acknowledged those. So we don't know exactly that. And then let me point something out to you, sir. When you start talking about there's no evidence whatsoever that there was any kind of plan that this would be part of a Democratic effort, why exactly do you suppose that Dianne Feinstein referred this woman to a lawyer in Bethesda who is a known Democratic activist, a Democratic fundraiser, a Democratic operative lawyer? Why do you suppose that she would end up with her rather than any one of 10 million lawyers in the Washington area? So pardon me, but I happen to believe there is ample evidence. And, sir, when you also say, Tom, when you say the press hasn't properly vetted whether groups or protesters are being paid, isn't that the truth, that the press has not properly vetted anything other than trying to destroy Brett Kavanaugh? They've been overly agitated about him. They've done damn little to nothing about what she is really like, what her background is. It's all this. Oh, mm-hmm. No, we can't ask any of those questions
her
because
background.
She's a victim.
I see.
Yeah. But through Vigniraja, there's no doubt that there's a coordinated effort among Democrats to block the Kavanaugh nomination. There's no doubt about that, I don't think. The question is whether or not Dr. Christine Blasey Ford is part of it. And there are going to be people who obviously disagree about that. But when, you know, Ms. Mitchell brings up some inconsistencies in Dr. Blasey Ford's testimony about flying and that kind of stuff. A number of people have pointed out inconsistencies in Mr. Kavanaugh's testimony as well. They talk about them as small, little inconsistencies or even untruths about what certain terms in his yearbook meant or what certain contentions that he made. I mean, there are a lot of people who were a little incredulous when he contended that he didn't listen to Ms. Ford's testimony the day that it happened. That's what he says, but there are an awful lot of people that think, boy, that would be an awfully hard thing to resist doing. But is this a matter of, you know, a legal argument in which, you know, one person, because of other things that they're saying, is found to be less credible than the other.
Yeah. Let me say two things about that. I mean, from my perspective, I watched Professor Ford. I watched Judge Kavanaugh. I found Professor Ford compelling and credible. I found Judge Kavanaugh to be less so. And part of it was his categorical claims about never having drank to a point where he couldn't remember things. Part of it was his temperament. Part of it was what he focused on and sort of how he interjected with the senators. But there are two sort of broader points. The first one is that this is the kind of reason we need to have a more thorough investigation. The reason why folks, frankly, from both sides in the end, we're calling for an FBI investigation is we shouldn't have unresolved issues like this hanging over Judge Kavanaugh. And that is related to the second reason, which is these are the kinds of conversations, this conversation we're having on the radio right now are the kinds of debates we typically have with respect to politicians, not justices. The Supreme Court is supposed to be the one institution that is above this. There was a time when, whether it was Justice Scalia or Justice Ginsburg, that 95, 96, 99 senators in Congress would vote to approve them. Today, we are so partisan about these things, and the legitimacy of that institution is tied to the belief that it is above politics. And when you hear Judge Kavanaugh shatter that belief, that faith, that this is an institution separate from the Clintons and the Bushes, it's a really, really disturbing outcome. And the only way, I think, to move forward, to have a really fulsome investigation, one that doesn't have a rush to judgment and have the process we saw with Neil Gorsuch. You know, we ultimately confirmed Justice Gorsuch after a appropriate nomination confirmation. I may have disagreed with President Trump's nomination of Justice Gorsuch, but he went through a process that gave Americans faith that the institution was still whole. I worry about that faith today.
All right, we got to take a break, and we will come back and continue this very important conversation. Thiru Vignaraj is a former prosecutor and former clerk to Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. He's currently a partner at the law firm DLA Piper here in Baltimore. Cleta Mitchell is a partner and political law attorney in the Washington, D.C. office of Foley & Lardner, LLP. And Ian Samuel is an associate professor of law at Indiana University and the co-host of First Monday, a weekly podcast about the Supreme Court. We'll continue our conversation about the Kavanaugh confirmation process and the future of the court when we come back. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR. To follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWYPR. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, it's Midday at the Movies. That's our monthly look at the latest in cinema with Anne Hornaday of The Washington Post and Jed Dietz, the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival. Jed has announced his intention to retire as the director of the film festival, so we'll talk about that and the future of the thing that he founded some 20 years ago. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will review Cat on a Hot Tin Roof at Baltimore Center Stage, as well as Sex with Strangers. That's the show at Fells Point Corner Theater. If you just joined us today, we're talking about the Supreme Court and the ongoing controversies surrounding the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh, who currently serves on the Court of Appeals in Washington. My guests are Ian Samuel, an associate professor at the Indiana University School of Law, Cleta Mitchell, who's a partner in the political law practice at the firm of Foley & Lardner in Washington, and Thiru Vignaraj, a former Maryland Deputy Attorney General and a litigator with DLA Piper here in Baltimore. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. Ms. Mitchell, about Judge Kavanaugh's demeanor and his countenance at the hearing on Thursday, there are people who have raised the specter that given his how angry and emotional he was, it showed a lack of the kind of temperament we should expect from a Supreme Court justice. What did you think? If you were advising Mr. Kavanaugh, and you've advised a number of congressional candidates and various people in your long career, if you were advising Mr. Kavanaugh about sort of how to play this, would you have advised him to do it, to play it the way he played it?
Well, you're suggesting that he played it. I think that this man was reacting to these attacks on the very essence of his being, after he has led an exemplary life, his entire adult life, that we know. Let us just stipulate, there are no allegations, none, no allegations about any untoward behavior on his part since he has been, say, out of law school. Let's start with that. There are none. So I think that if I had were the victim of those kinds of attacks and I had been criticized roundly all day Tuesday, all day Wednesday of last week after his interview with Martha McCallum on national television, and people said, well, he doesn't seem very disturbed about this. He must be, these must be true. So he was criticized for not being emotional and not reacting angrily to these very scurrilous attacks. And I think what he decided to do was just that he was going to defend himself and his honor and a lifetime of exemplary behavior. And I think if any of you gentlemen were treated to the same kind of allegations without warning, out of the blue, when you led a life of that people have admired and respected you, and you haven't done anything ever in your adult life when you've been accused of something like this, I think it's I think it's fair to say that he didn't play it. He was just reacting as a normal person probably would, and as likely many of you would if you were accused of the same thing.
And Ian Samuel, there are many who agree with Ms. Mitchell that say that you know, Mr. Kavanaugh is being very authentic. There's a Marist NBC poll that came out last week that said 54% at least of Republicans think that even if the allegations concerning Dr. Blasey Ford are true, that in and of itself is not disqualifying, and that this wasn't part of the poll, but that Mr. Kavanaugh's authentic, sincere dismay and disgust at this process. He was giving us, you know, a real unfiltered reaction, and that has nothing to do with his judicial temperament and how he would rule in terms of various cases that would come before him as a Supreme Court justice. What's your reaction? I mean, what if most people, in fact, think, you know, even if it is true, as Ms. Mitchell says, there are certainly no allegations of anything that's happened since he's been in law school.
Yeah, I think that what Ms. Mitchell is bold enough to suggest is what I think probably more than 54% of Republicans actually believe, which is that if he did it, it's not that big of a deal. That is what I think is truly in the hearts of most of his defenders. They saw Dr. Blasey Ford's testimony. They saw how credible she was. They have more shame than the previous speaker did. They won't want to cast doubt on her. They don't want to suggest that she's engaged in a conspiracy. So there is only one route left. And that route is, well, boys will be boys. This kind of thing happens. And we don't want to tarnish the life of a good man over this kind of thing.
I didn't say that.
And there are lots of people, excuse me, I'm still speaking. There are lots of people who believe that. And I think the previous speaker is one of them, whether she will admit it or not. But one person who does not think that is Brett Kavanaugh. Because he has not said, sure, I did it, but I've grown up a lot since then. Because Brett Kavanaugh, a good Catholic like me, knows that before reconciliation must come confession and penance. You can be forgiven for doing bad things. You can be forgiven for doing awful things. But first, you must admit that you did them. And that has not been his defense. His defense has been, this never happened. Nothing like it has ever happened. I've never in my life drank so much that I couldn't remember something that I participated in. And so that is the terms we have to take this on. And I think that that has become so implausible that there's this fallback to the second layer of defense, which is, well, nothing has happened since he was out of law school. A fascinating qualifier, because I recall actually that a person becomes an adult when they're 18. He was at Yale when he was 18 years old. And indeed, there are credible allegations that he was engaged in misconduct then. So I think the qualifier and the sort of goalpost moving is very interesting there. But I think it really reveals the game, which is, well, wasn't this a long time ago? Is it a big deal? I think that it is.
And through Vignaraja, as a prosecutor, when it comes to corroborating evidence to the claims made by Dr. Ford or anybody else, is that a reasonable expectation in cases like this? I don't know whether or not Mr. Kavanaugh has ever blacked out from drinking, and how would I even ever know that? How would anybody know the sort of with that kind of specificity what happened with Mr. Kavanaugh as an undergraduate or as a student at the Yale School of Law? I mean, how important people do talk about corroborating evidence, and I think perhaps they're trying to or they're wondering whether or not the FBI will unearth any corroborating incriminating evidence in the extended background check that they're doing as we speak.
You know, in cold cases, corroboration is, of course, especially important on both sides. And you can go back and forth about the corroboration that exists on one side versus the other. I think I've shared my view on who is more credible. But this is, again, why an investigation should have happened in the first place, why a complete investigation should have happened. But there is a broader point, which is that when we talk about Judge Kavanaugh's response, it's not just the categorical denials, which seem at odds with some of the evidence that he presented, you know, whether it's the yearbook entries or the calendars. It's the fact that he said certain things that we've never heard a nominee to the Supreme Court say. We've never heard a person invoke presidential partisan politics. And that's a cloud that's gonna loom over his votes for years to come, whether he remains a federal appellate judge or whether he is anointed to the Supreme Court, because we're talking about every case involving Democrats versus Republicans, every case involving gender equity, sexual violence, criminal justice. All of a sudden, we're going to be looking through the prism of what he said, these sort of remarkable comments that he made in his defense. And I think that is as big a problem as the lack of credibility that we have with respect to his comments before the Senate.
And Ms. Mitchell, when it comes to this corroborating evidence, what would you would there be any evidence that the FBI could unearth in this extra week of investigation that would be disqualifying? Are there things we're missing about Mr. Kavanaugh or any judicial nominee for the Supreme Court in terms of what should qualify or disqualify any individual?
Look, the way an FBI background investigation is undertaken, and let's not forget that he's been through six of them. He had access to the nuclear codes when he worked in the White House. And the way an FBI background investigation works is that you give the FBI, when you fill out your paperwork, the names of people to talk to who've known you for a long period of time. And they go talk to those people. And then those people say, is there anybody else we should talk to? And then they talk to those people. And is there anybody else that we should talk to? And is there anything that, about which you are aware that we should know about this person? It isn't as though this guy just happened in off the street and we know nothing about him. He has been through six, now seven, eight, I suppose, background investigations. So I don't know exactly what it is you're looking for. The person who has not been through any kind of background investigation, the person who has put our country through this turmoil, is Christine Ford. And I actually would like to know more about her.
Well, as of yesterday, the FBI hadn't... But as of yesterday, the FBI hadn't contacted her, and she was more than willing to speak with them. What do you make of that, Ms. Mitchell?
What do I make of the fact that FBI hasn't contacted her? I don't know what to make of that. I mean, I think that they should talk to her. They should try to... I think they should talk to people who knew her in high school. They've certainly talked to people who's known Brett Kavanaugh all these years. They've talked to them on multiple occasions, many times. But I don't know that anybody is investigating to see what was her state of mind, what was her conduct. I don't know. But I think that one of the things that is so convenient about coming up with allegations that are so remote in time, and then to say, oh, but we can't ask those questions because we have to believe the victim and we can't test her credibility. I think that's preposterous, and I don't think that that is in keeping with the rule of law.
You know, Tom, I think it's an important question. There's certainly people that debate whether the next person that would be appointed from a jurisprudential view would be better or worse or the same as Judge Kavanaugh. I think the question that I would put to Ms. Mitchell and to others who defend Judge Kavanaugh is, assume for a moment that we had absolute proof that when he was 17 or 18 years old, he did drink to excess to a point where he essentially perjured himself before the United States Senate, that he did, in fact, engage in the kind of conduct that Professor Ford has accused him of. I think that the question that the professor put to Ms. Mitchell, I think, is one that, you know, people should answer, which is, would that matter? For a lot of us, that would matter, not only because he has not taken responsibility for it, but because it reflects on his temperament, his character, and how seriously he is taking this process. What I'm fearful of is that Many believe that it's more important. I've heard folks say this on, you know, on the news. It's more important to get the fifth vote to overturn Roe versus Wade than it is to inquire whether or not Judge Kavanaugh did this or not. So I think a fair question to put to people that still support the nomination is, if this is true, that he misrepresented himself to the United States Senate, that he in fact did engage in this criminal conduct from when he was 17 or 18 years old, is that disqualifying or not?
And Ms. Mitchell, what's your reaction? I mean, we don't know whether or not it's absolutely true, but what is your reaction to
that? Well, why do you say that? He testified, he's testified under oath multiple times that he did not do this. And you're asking a hypothetical, if. Let me just say this. I know one thing for sure, and that is people function in patterns. And there is no doubt in my mind that this man is not guilty as of these allegations, because he would have engaged in that kind of conduct over his adult life. We have not one scintilla of a suggestion that he has done that. So I actually do not believe, I don't believe the allegations. I believe him, but I also am fascinated about the fact that somehow, because people say, what you have just said is that people like me support him because it's more important to get a vote to overturn Roe v. Wade. I don't believe the court will overturn Roe v. Wade with or without Judge Kavanaugh. Frankly, courts all over the country have already abandoned Roe v. Wade decades ago. We no longer have the Roe v. Wade construct. That is completely out the window as a matter of law. But I will ask you this. What I have heard Democrats say, starting with Chuck Schumer, starting with who is the minority leader of the Senate, saying before Brett Kavanaugh was even named, that he was going to do everything he could to oppose the nomination, whoever President Trump nominated.
All right.
And all of it is said, and all of it is in defense of Roe v. Wade. The means justify the ends, because we have to protect abortion rights. And all of this can be boiled down to that one issue. And I think it's interesting that you're the one who brought it up, not me.
All right, here's Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. He's on the floor of the Senate Monday, blasting Democrats for using what he referred to as McCarthy-esque tactics of personal destruction to torpedo the Kavanaugh nomination.
If you listen carefully, Mr. President, you can practically hear the sounds of the Democrats moving the goalposts. But their goal hadn't moved an inch, not an inch. The goal's been the same all along. And so let me make it very clear. The time for endless delay and obstruction has come to a close. Judge Kavanaugh's nomination is out of committee. We're considering it here on the floor. And Mr. President, we'll be voting this week.
And Ian Samuel, I don't think there's any doubt that the Democrats would love for this nomination to be delayed until after the election. That is certainly a political strategy that doesn't surprise anybody. So there are, you know, all of these subsets of factoids involved in this about whether or not he's more believable than she was, et cetera, et cetera. But the Democrats do have a vested political interest in making sure that Mr. Kavanaugh isn't confirmed before the election. And if for some reason the Senate flips and the Congress flips, it'll be a very different environment after the election.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And of course, that's politics. I mean, of course, we have not had a Supreme Court justice confirmed by a Senate of the opposite party of the president since Clarence Thomas. And there is no good reason to expect it'll ever happen again. The Republicans held open Justice Scalia's seat after he died, hoping that they could win the presidential election. And they did. And they filled it with Neil Gorsuch. And of course, the Democrats would prefer to keep this seat open, too. But the difference in treatment with Gorsuch and Kavanaugh illustrates something very important, which is that the Democrats oppose both of those nominees on the merits. They disagree with their vision of the law, and they disagree with how they're likely to behave as judges. And that is perfectly fair, just as Republicans disagreed with how Merrick Garland was likely to discharge his duties on the Supreme Court and opposed him for that reason. There is nothing wrong with that. The problem that the Republicans have at the moment is that members of their caucus, who are quite amenable to the way that Judge Kavanaugh thinks about the law, do take these allegations quite seriously. So Senator Flake, for example, has said he's a conservative. He thinks that Judge Kavanaugh is a conservative judge, and he wishes he could sort of just vote for him. But he takes these allegations very seriously. And I think that really gives lie to the suggestion that this is all part of some sort of grand conspiracy, that any nominee is going to be treated this way. You know, Judge Gorsuch was not treated this way. He was opposed on the merits, yes, very stringently, yes, and that's appropriate. But the reason these things are coming up is not because of some master plot by the Democrats who oppose him on the merits. They're coming up because these are serious things, and members of the Republican caucus take them seriously, and that's the difference. And you're not going to be able to remove politics from a Supreme Court nomination, but this particular thing that is holding up Judge Kavanaugh is really not a question of politics at all.
Ian Samuels on the faculty of the Indiana University School of Law. Thiru Vignaraja is a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. He's a partner with the law firm DLA Piper here in Baltimore. Cleta Mitchell is a political law attorney in Washington with the firm of Foley & Lardner. We'll have more on the Supreme Court when we return. Before we take a break, a note from Ronnie, who gets in touch with us via email. What about this boys will be boys argument and its intersection with race? Who was allowed to be a boy? Was Trayvon Martin? Was Tamir Rice? Was Emmett Till allowed to be just a kid? Who we afford this privilege to reveals a lot about us. Our phone number here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. A bunch of phone calls. We will try to get to some of them when we come back. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're talking today about the Supreme Court and the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to succeed Justice Anthony Kennedy. If Mr. Kavanaugh is confirmed, the balance on the court in terms of political philosophy will certainly change, but two things will not change. All of the members of the court will be either Catholic or Jewish. Catholics and Jews make up less than 23% of the U.S. population, but it's 100% on the Supreme Court, and all of its members were either trained at Harvard or Yale. My guests today are Thiru Vignaraja, a former federal and city prosecutor. He's a partner with the law firm DLA Piper here in Baltimore. Cleta Mitchell is a political law attorney in Washington with the firm Foley & Lardner. She's represented, among many other clients, the National Republican Senatorial Committee, the National Republican Congressional Committee. And Ian Samuels is an associate professor of law at the Indiana University School of Law. He co-hosts a podcast called First Mondays about the Supreme Court. We got a lot of phone calls. We'll try to get to some of them. Email here at midday, midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet @MiddayWYPR. If you want to get online for the queue and the phone calls, 410-662-8780. Let's go to Nuvi in Mount Washington. Welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling.
Hello.
Hi. You're on the air.
Well, as far as the comment of Ms. Mitchell, that Judge Kavanaugh is a normal person, I beg to differ. If he will be elected, he will be sitting on the highest court of the land, and his behavior has shown that he is totally unworthy of such honor. His testimony, in my view, was disgraceful, aggressive, and wallowing in self-pity, and hiding behind an elitist and untitled male experience. Besides, the entry in his yearbook, he testified about those. Well, they were mendacious because the meaning of those entries were debunked. They are, in fact, totally disregarding of women, demeaning of women, and aggressive.
Okay, well, Nuvi,
really
thank you. Thank you for your comment. I appreciate it. I think we get the gist of it. And Ms. Mitchell, this is not Mr. Kavanaugh's first difficult confirmation process. The Bush administration, President George W. Bush, nominated Mr. Kavanaugh in 2003. He was not confirmed until 2006. The American Bar Association, which after the hearing last Thursday called for an FBI investigation back in 2006, they actually downgraded their endorsement of Judge Kavanaugh, saying that they worried about his professional experience and the question of his freedom from bias and open-mindedness. This obviously falls, you know, the people who find themselves on either side of this issue can be parsed any number of ways. But in terms of Mr. Kavanaugh's countenance and his relationship with women, it seems that you're not convinced the way some of the other listeners are.
I'm not. I know too many women who are friends with him, who've worked with him. I don't know him personally, but I have so many colleagues and friends and associates who do know him personally, who have worked with him, who have worked for him. And all of them are unanimous in their commentary about how he has always treated them with respect. He has given female lawyers, associates, opportunities to rise in the ranks. A majority of his law clerks have been women. Not a single one of them has ever expressed anything but complete admiration for him. So I just think that this is, you know, because he's not black like Clarence Thomas, he can't say this is a high-tech lynching. But I think what he did say is absolutely true, that this anger that has possessed the American left and the Democratic Party since 2016, since the moment Donald Trump was elected, has been a nonstop rage. And it has, you can't sit there and deny the existence and the persistence of the outraged left. And I think this is just a manifestation of that, however unfortunate for Brett Kavanaugh.
Let's go to Nick in West Baltimore. Nick, welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Tom. Let me just say a couple things. The kinds of lies, like those being espoused by, you know, Republican operatives like the one on the air on the program today, are actually very easy for people to evaluate because they sound very similar to the lies that many men and their supporters who have now been identified as sexual criminals have used in their defense for years.
And before you go on, Nick, Ms. Mitchell is not a Republican operative. She's a lawyer represented
please, Tom,
people.
Allow me my perspective for just another moment.
If you're going to call one of our guests a liar, then that's one thing. But I'd love to have you make your point without any personal attacks.
So these types of patterns are very easy for people to evaluate as being not a valid defense of people who over maybe portions of their lives or some of or all of their lives prey on women. And you have people like President Trump saying it's a very scary time for men. You know what I can say? I'm not scared. The men that I know and associate with are not scared. I know a lot of women, many of whom, most of whom, who have experienced sexual violence in their lives, who are scared because of that reality. But to shift it and say that it's the men in society who should be scared now, again, your reasonable listeners will be able to tell how farcical such statements are.
The level of
entitlement that he has on display is profound. And one last statement, Tom. People need to understand this goes much beyond Roe versus Wade. The actual thing at stake here is the complete and total consolidation of power by the ultra elite, and they are in the final stages of clamping down on everything. Putting Kavanaugh in that role has something to do with Roe versus Wade, but it is much more about allowing the 1% of the 1% to have complete and total, unquestionable control over the planet.
Okay, well, Nick, well, thanks for your perspective. I appreciate it. Ian Samuel, Mr. Trump ran on a platform that said he would appoint conservative judges. He even intimated and sometimes stated that he would appoint judges who would, in fact, overturn Roe v. Wade. There are a number of people who agree with Ms. Mitchell that say that that's unlikely to happen. Who knows? I mean, no one can speculate about that at this juncture. But Mr. Trump ran on this. The election was held, and people voted for him, many times sort of holding their nose about many other things that Donald Trump was saying because of this one particular issue. This is a political process. I mean, how should it or how could it not be?
I think that's right. I think that one of the things that President Trump did when he was campaigning is he actually released, you know, really what they would call in the UK almost a shadow cabinet, right? He said, if I am elected, I'm going to draw judges from this list. That is something we had not seen before that I think is actually a salutary practice that should be encouraged because it does give people a sense of what they're voting for. And that is why I really don't understand why people say things like, oh, we don't know what Brett Kavanaugh thinks about Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey. I mean, look, I know a lot of legal conservatives who are very smart people, who are principled and intelligent, and I do not know a single one of them who thinks thinks that Roe v. Wade or Planned Parenthood v. Casey was right the day that it was decided. I would be astonished, literally astonished, to discover that Brett Kavanaugh has a single good thing to say about those opinions. And that is fine. Many people disagree with those opinions on the merits, and we can have that conversation. But what I think is telling is that when you say something like that, when you say, well, of course Brett Kavanaugh thinks Roe v. Wade is wrongly decided. Every smart legal conservative thinks that. It's kind of a requirement of entry that you think that that decision is wrongly decided. People don't say, yeah, he thinks that and he's right about that. The usual response in public forums is, well, we don't know what he thinks, or I'm sure he wouldn't vote to overturn Roe versus Wade, which illustrates, I think, that there's not actually a ton of popular appeal to that statement, that if people voted for President Trump, that, you know, the sort of majority in the Electoral College that he got might have been built in part on people who were wanted Roe v. Wade overturned. I think that there is substantial evidence that that is true, but that it is a loser politically in the broader context of American politics, which is why people will not admit what is plain for everyone to see. That is why he has the job, is because they want somebody who will overturn Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey. That's the entire idea.
And Thiru Vignaraju made the point earlier in the show about how this can sully the court, sully Mr. Kavanaugh's participation as a justice if he is confirmed. I wonder, let me ask you a broader question. Why are so many Supreme Court justices being so public about many of their feelings about things? We have Justice Ginsburg during the election saying how terrible, what a disaster it would be if President Trump, then candidate Trump, were elected. We've had Justice Thomas giving speeches to the Heritage Foundation saying that opponents of limited government are misguided. We've had Justice Alito making some controversial remarks. We've had a lot of Supreme Court justices being very public. I mean, we saw a very public display of Brett Kavanaugh. Since when do these the justices on the court feel at liberty to go out and talk so much?
I mean, I think the justices, and I'm speculating here, are genuinely concerned about the soul of the Supreme Court. You know, you heard Justice Kennedy very recently talking about the death and demise of democracy in the United States, talking in ways that you don't typically hear these even-tempered justices speak. And I think there's two things that are happening. The first one is that this is one of those rare acts of American government that you can't take back. A president issues an executive order, he can rescind it, he can revise it. Congress passes a law, a future Congress can repeal it, they can revise it. But an appointment to the Supreme Court is a lifetime tenure by design, and you've got to get it right. And tied to that is the second point, which is the strength of the Supreme Court comes from its legitimacy. If people believe that it is a partisan institution, it is very difficult for those edicts to be respected and honored and enforced. It wasn't that long ago. You know, after Brown versus Board of Education, the governor of Arkansas ordered the Arkansas National Guard to block the schoolhouse doors at Little Rock Central High School to not honor a unanimous decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. And it took President Eisenhower deploying the 101st Airborne Division to Little Rock, Arkansas, to make sure that the law of the land was in fact enforced in the streets and schoolhouses of the country. And that is because ultimately we don't have an army, we don't have the power to tax, the court has its legitimacy, and that is at a crisis moment in ways that it hasn't been in a generation.
Mm-hmm. And Ms. Mitchell, we're out of time. Let me give you the last word. If the Congress flips on the 6th of November and becomes a Democratic Congress, whether or not the Senate itself flips, the Democrats would then have subpoena power. They would have the power to hold hearings and stuff. If Justice Kavanaugh or if Judge Kavanaugh becomes Justice Kavanaugh and hearings like that take place, will it in fact sully the court? Will it in any way impede Mr. Kavanaugh's capacity to serve as an unbiased justice?
I believe that he has been an unbiased judge. He has served well as a judge, and I think once confirmed, he will serve brilliantly as a Supreme Court justice. That does not mean that I don't think, because I do think that the Democrats and their partisans and their crazy left-wing mobster supporters who are just mobbing, roaming, they're literally roaming mobs through the Senate hallways as we speak, which follows upon the shouting and the protesters, who, by the way, were paid. And if you'd like to investigate that and vet that, I'd be happy to direct
you. Well, there is a First Amendment, as you well know, Ms. Mitchell, and that right of protest does, of course, exist for everybody. But I appreciate all three of you joining the conversation today. I'm sorry that's all the time we have, and I'm sorry we were not able to get to a number of calls that we had, but I'm grateful to Cleta Mitchell, Ian Sanders, Samuel and Thuru Vignaraj. That is it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, it's Midday at the Movies with Jed Dietz of the Maryland Film Festival and Ann Hornaday of the Washington Post. Plus, we'll have reviews of the new shows at Baltimore Center Stage and Fells Point Corner Theater. We are grateful to the Baltimore Chef Shop for providing lunch today. They're on the Avenue in Hamden. They offer a variety of private events and cooking classes for kids and adults, including baking and international cuisines. Tomorrow night, they're offering a class in Moroccan cuisine, and on Friday, it's Thai street food. More on the web at BaltimoreChefShop.com. Life in the Balance with Aaron Henkin is up next after a break for news at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.